I've been on the surface of things that may now look as though we could start writing a story. The story of the first millennium of which we know, the millennium of pure speech. And nothing else existed but either peace or war, either speech or silence. We return to this, but I must draw your attention to the fact that our own language, our vocabulary, the way we talk about history today is very faulty. And without your noticing the sickness of your speech, I can hardly hope to be understood. Because that's the hardest thing to say to anybody, that he cannot speak correctly. But I assure you that to study history is an attempt to correct one's language. In a much deeper sense, when you learn a foreign language, there you learn all the falsities about your in your own language and in the foreign language. That only doubles the confusion. What is wrong with our own use of the word history? Well, I try to prepare you for some better understanding by reading you this monumental inscription in Concord, New Hampshire. I attach great significance to this monument, and I hope you will be good enough to copy it for your own preservation. In Concord, New Hampshire, the Arc de Triomphe, the arc in stone, has this strange inscription: to the memory of our soldiers and sailors, the city of Concord builds this monument. No year given. So there you have the typical effort of us human beings as mortals to think of history as something that went on before us. And if we remember it, that's all we have to do. Memory is the word of the monument. And the word monument, of course, has to do with memory. Where there are monuments, we can more easily remember than when these persons have just died and disappeared. See, so they leave a monument. Horace has his famous words, which ends the antiquity, exegi monument ere perennius. I have established a monument that is more enduring than all. And he has his poems. And he was the first, as all these Augustan poets at the threshold of Christianity, they were all full, Virgil, for example, and Horace, they were full of some understanding of the problem of eternity. And we have forgotten this again. What it takes to be remembered. You will not be remembered, I suppose. And to be remembered just for the Nobel Prize is also very little. Because we want to be remembered by people who love us. Loving memory, as here in this and on this monument, is something very different from being registered in the Encyclopedia Britannica. So the word memory today is in eclipse, I would say, in comparison to scientific history, to all the monumental books on the history of the last world war, which I suppose could just as well be fast forgotten. What we remember today, and what deserves to be remembered, is not the same thing. And that's a very serious question. You know that a whole psychological theory, Mr. Freud's psychoanalysis, has been based on the fact that the people remember the wrong things. They suffer from repressions. So they do not remember that they wanted to sleep with their mother, allegedly, and they try to remember other more pleasant things. Memory and history are today at odds. It is not true that because we remember, we understand history, and certainly the history you learn in school has very little to do with your own memories. And there is a cleavage. And the first 1,000 years of history, of which we know, the first millennium, has been made an attempt to prevent any cleavage between history and memory. It should be remembered what should be historical, and it was remembered in history, you see, what you could remember because you had experience it yourself. You have not experienced the last World War, but you are meant to remember it, and of course you can't. So that's what is today called history. Find it some book, maybe true, maybe not true, and one cannot read enough opposing opinions, because what is truth? What is has happened really in history? There are as many schools of history today as there are parties and interests. Now I like to bring up to you some quite different opposite point about memory and history, to show you that a healing power, or at least an opposite energy, has been at work in history. A famous, now still famous German poetess wrote 120 years ago in a letter. In 1843 actually was written. And I think the good woman deserves your the memory of her name in your heart. Because she has really said an important and quite unbelievable word. She wrote, "I would like to be read in 100 years, and perhaps I will succeed, because nothing is more easy. It's like with the egg of Columbus. You know, he put his egg so that it would stand by splashing it on the plate. It's as easy as the egg of Columbus. The only thing required is the resolute foregoing of success today." So she said, you see, if I want to be immortal, I have not to think of today. So this would mean that she couldn't be remembered for what happened today, that she would be prepared. She would be the seed, the grain of seed in the ground that 100 years later was, you see, mighty, but not today. The whole Christian era has attempted to do just this, to cure the cleavage between memory and history by foregoing immediate success, by saying it doesn't matter that I am remembered now. I become historical by my power to forego this recognition. This is unknown to you. You look only for the who is who, and you look for the headlines in the papers, and you think if you don't, I'm not a success today. I can give you the strangest experiences of publishers in this country who confuse success with the moment. They have no idea that any good deed has to undergo an incubation, that it takes a long time before an act bears fruit and can be understood and remembered. So before memory happens, much has to go on before. An historical event is an event that, yes, party is remembered, but party also has foregone the claim to be remembered right away, and has been waiting, you see, lying fallow on the ground until the next springtime, when it would be grow up and shoot up and be visible monumentally. The whole story of our era is an attempt to try how much success we have to forego before we are meaningfully successful. In the years of Peter and Paul in Rome, you see, the only thing the Romans and the Greeks in Hellas and in Palestine, the Syrians, wanted, the return of Emperor Nero. He had been murdered by the legions who were hung up with this monster. He had murdered his own mother, as you know. Just the same, Nero was acclaimed he would return 10 years later in glory in 78 of our era. Fortunately, he didn't, but this is what the naive people in politics do think. Perhaps they think that Mr. Reagan will return in 10 years. It's very strange. You must not believe that people living at a certain time have any idea of the historical stream in which they move. You don't understand history. You don't know what's going on. You can't. You have not sacrificed. You have never made this distinction between future and past. And since you live in the moment, you don't understand anything. We all don't. Newspapers are the best means of confusing us about history. Nothing that is in the papers is of importance in a lasting way. It can be of importance, but not because it is in the paper. This is today the conflict, and well, that's why I felt at the end of my life I should try to teach you the understanding of history. History moves then in a strange manner in that the past and the future can only be understood by people who are quite indifferent to the present. Anybody immersed in something he wants, get rich, be elected president, so you see, cannot understand history. Success as of now and succession as of yesterday and tomorrow are in conflict. And this is why it is difficult to understand the story of primitive man, because his whole story is a total indifference to immediate success. And you are not indifferent to success. There's a good ones of you, of course, I, to a certain extent, but we are made to be ashamed of this. You will always find, take your own generation, you see. The important man, of course, today is a boy of 18 or 19 who prepares himself to become president at 60. Now, he cannot run around and demonstrate in Berkeley, you see. He has better things to do. And those who want to have the success visibly gather 1,000 or 2,000 heads together, or legs, whatever it is, and demonstrate. Anything that is demonstrable in terms of is form. Now, I don't say that we don't have some form in life. We all need this. We have to go to the theater where 1,000 people can clap in applause. But you all know that is not the argument, really. The applause of in a given moment does not show that this is a case of God. It is only when all the 1,000 people are arrested and go to prison for 10 years or be sent to Siberia in exile that you find out whether there is a Dostoevsky among them. So the problem of history today is in a very bad way because we reckon life by seconds, by minutes. Reading time, 7 minutes, 3 seconds. Wherever you see this, I can only say, take your choice. I mean, this is the tickling of your senses of the moment, and the other is your unique life over a long range of time. And it's a difference between a mother and a harlot. Now, the first millennium of mankind has tried to take men out of this flow of moments, this insect life of bees and fleas and fishes and lions, and to give him the conviction that he's there forever. The everness, what we used to call eternity, in which I'm afraid today, is not very much high in currency in our Indian language. I don't know, have any other word. We call it perpetuity. The revolution in perpetuation, the Russians call it this problem, you see, of eternity. It's the same word, the idea, you see. A revolution is only a revolution if it is a revolution in perpetuity. A revolution of one day is over. So the word eternal, I cannot introduce because you wouldn't know what it is. Would think it's a pious life of some church people. But the desire for eternity is in all of us. And so let me set out to say, or to discover, or to describe to you in which manner our earliest ancestors have tried to emerge from this momentary McCarthy politics, from the sensation of the day, from the hatreds of the civil wars of any moment, into something of perpetuity. I just read yesterday a chapter by von Quigley on McCarthy, and he showed that it's very eloquent chapter, the incredible fact that this man really lived by the moment, that if he had lied about somebody, he had forgot next day that he had, and said, oh, did I? I didn't mean to. The lack of memory is perhaps the most outstanding feature of the modern politician. But you are all visited by the same. This infamous impudence of saying, I didn't. Did I really? Yesterday? Oh, yes, it was yesterday. You know, it was today. My convictions are, you see, just as in, at the shopper's corner. The prices change every minute. Now, this is what you are visited by. You see, the lack of unity, of continuity. You will not be pinned down to anything you have said yesterday. And you will say, how can I know what I have to say tomorrow? As soon as this has gripped you, you see, you are on the way to the dummy. The constancy of your heart, of your mind, of your soul, of your body, is the condition of history. If there is nothing permanent, nothing that remains, there's no history. It's nonsense to speak of history when everything is just in the kaleidoscope, it will change. When all your convictions, as you see, consist in the fact that you had every day a different conviction, you had no conviction. That's how many people live today. With all the aliases, you know, there are people who have five or six different lives, the nine lives of a cat. And no such people. And you cannot cope with them. You cannot reach them. They don't know where they are, who they are, how they are, when they are. They think they are wonderful because they adapt themselves. You know, there has been a whole school, the behavioral school in this country, this strange man Watson, who said that behaviorism is a doctrine, how we adapt, how do we adjust ourselves. All these poor school children have to adapt themselves to conditions. I don't see why they have to adapt themselves. I mean, I'm a wonderful man because I'm absolutely inadaptable. See, I hear that to adapt oneself is a merit, is a value. Why is this a value? It may be very convenient. It may be very, make you a lazy person, of course, which to adapt himself because he doesn't want to act, he doesn't want to respond, he doesn't want to say what he thinks, and he doesn't know what he thinks. So, in order never to find out what he thinks himself, he never says anything. That's called adaptation. The adaptation of the unfittest, that's the rule of today. It's all nonsense. I mean, why should we adapt? To what? I won't adapt. Adapt yourself to me. You have to, you're sitting there at my house, not at you. Where is the adjustment or the adaptation? I can only reconcile you to the kindness of coming at 11 o'clock on Thursday and Tuesday by giving you something which makes you more yourself. If this exchange takes place, any lecture has done its part, you see. It has made you more yourself and me more myself. But certainly not adaptation. I don't wish you to adapt to anything. So, it is the essence of speech, of the creation of speech in humanity, to spare men the adaptation to any one moment. Speech is always more permanent than the moment in which I live at this moment. And the great criterion of the tribal order has been that names go on for thousands of years. If you think that is laughable, let me tell you that in the small Antilles, in the British part of the Caribbean Sea, on those islands, those small islands on which the rich Americans go for summer, resort in winter, that there are many Negroes. It's a Negro population. And all these Negroes, since they escaped the southern plantation owners and their slavery, enslavement, these Negroes all know from which tribes in Africa they stem. Now that's not a small thing, because if you come to think about you people here in this class, Who of you knows what your ancestor in 1600 was? And what his name was and where he lived? Very few of you. Tell me. All right. But you know that's an exception. It is not an exception with these good people on these islands. Every one of them knows to which tribe he belongs. And this name makes him the equal of any white Protestant American. And because in the South they have had the effrontery and the shamelessness to destroy the family relations, the tribal relations of their Negroes, they have really enslaved men and have broken his back. And the problem is not slavery, but the problem is names. Because a name survives your changes. You are young, you are old, you have the same name. And any man who can say, when he is called, his name is called, that's me, enters the courts of history. And because you don't know this, you don't understand history, you think always history is something Greek, something scientific, something to be known from the outside. Here the Greeks in Salamis or in the Persians in Marathon. That's not speech, that's not history. History is only when this town of New Hampshire, in New Hampshire, Concord, can say to the memory of our sailors, when you can appropriate, you see, something that has happened as yours. Before there is no history. And after that there is no history. What you know about world history is not yours. Unless you appropriate it. Unless you say one day, that's really me. I would have done the same. Without identity, no history. And the great illness of all the professor soil examination on history is that they allow you to write papers without your participation. We are asked to identify yourself with this. What's this? Do we sit in judgment why the Trojans had to be destroyed by the Greeks? Only if you weep for Hector, or if you participate in the rape of Helena. Otherwise, it's not your business to know it at all. And that's why Homer had to write the story in such a way that you may weep. As soon as you weep about Hector's death, you are allowed to read Homer. Otherwise, if you read it, you do harm to your soul. And you all do harm to your soul 10 times a day today. And that's why you at the end become totally indifferent people. People who know too much without sympathy and without antipathy are the curse of the earth today. They know more than they should know. And that they can know, and that they may know. We may not know anything without yes or no and thank you and please. If you say of Hector's death, oh please let me die the same death, that's great. Or if you see Thersites, the Greek, Bob Hope. I don't want to offend Bob Hope, by the way. But I have no word for the. Fool. No other example. If you do not take sides in reading a poem, you don't deserve to read the poem. Don't read it. You may write a major thesis on this and get an A in the thesis, you see. But that has nothing to do with the poem and the poet. That's a cheap game, which we all play now in these overflowing politics. It's very serious, you see. The ordinary man at the filling station is much less in danger of his soul today than you are. You are allowed to read too much, to know too many things, and not to know them at all. And that is no use. It spoils you. It ruins you. How can you educate a child if the child knows that you have 90% of your knowledge in indifference, in cold blood? You should only tell your child the stories for which you get hot under the collar, which are very important, which make people cry or makes people laugh. In different things, you must improve this. Rather. And they speak of urbanization and of rubbish heaps, you see, in the cities, but it's not the visible rubbish heaps. It's the invisible rubbish heaps in your brains, in your skulls, that is so terrifying. That you listen and know 1,000 more things than you can take sides for or against. It's very difficult to avoid, I know, but I must warn you that you cannot understand an ancient tribe, or in anthropology, any still existing tribe, be it in California, be it in among the Eskimos, or be it now in Africa, where we come into this tribal life at the moment in which it dissolves, and to see all the sufferings of the Katanga Negroes or of the Australian Bushmen, you must understand that what has kept them going for much longer than you, for 7,000-8,000 years, is the selective power of their memory. They have remembered what one has to remember in order to remain human. They've forgotten everything else. And the first thing they have remembered are their ancestors. With the help of ancestry, of progeny, of forefathers, these people find themselves as nobility. And I assure you, these men in the Caribbean, with their names of 300 years standing, they should leave the other Negroes now to a better life, to a free life, to a noble life, because they are noble. Anybody who can identify his existence on the earth with 300 years back is lifted above his toothache as of the moment. He can go to the dentist and see, but that's just passing. The dentist is not of first rate importance to him. He can suffer, he can be mutilated, he can be operated on, he can vote, he can travel, but that is not the man. If we turn to these primeval tribesmen, of which now the remnants are scattered over the globe, and which our anthropologists, so to speak, try to enlighten and to speak of and to describe to us. It's the last minute. Our language has destroyed any understanding of the connection between memory and history. You actually, if you come to think of it, think that history has nothing to do with your memory. You see, you can read a history book, you see, and know it all, and there's no memory involved. As soon as you see it, you believe this, you are barbarian. You're hopeless. Nothing will help your soul. You know things you shouldn't know, and you've forgotten things you should know. But most people live this way. That's what is called urbanization. In a village, this cannot happen. There are people of three different generations, or four different generations, you really see, all around you. And you know that their lives have been formed by their living through different states of awareness, different states of memory. It's the same person who danced at 18, you see, and now walks slowly at 80. And because it is the same person, all the externals of life don't matter compared to our identity. And the modern poet, modern writers who describe the cruelty of young men, for example, towards old, can only capitalize on this urbanization fact, where young people can laugh of the old, out of court the old people, because they think that will never happen to them. Wherever you have this non-understanding of different ages, of another age, by either by the old or by the young, it makes absolutely no difference, or by the manager in power, if he was just 45 and has still 20 years before he retires, with regard to the man who just happens to be 66 and has now to retire, and you find this in this country as the prepossession, as the obsession of most people, when they must retire, you see, and when he must retire. And as soon as you have this, humanity goes. These people, wolf eats wolf. Life begins where death is survived. Will you take this down? History begins where death is survived. That's history. Where it doesn't matter that you here sit, you see. You'll be here with us tomorrow and all our tomorrow, whether here or not. And that is the essence of the historical process, the selection of the undying, of the what, with a different dangerous word, is called undying or immortal. I don't like the word because obviously we all die, but we all can be resurrected. History is the story of men's resurrection. It's not the story of our permanency. No, not one of us must try to be permanent. Because I lecture here, I'm not allowed to say I can lecture when I'm 90 years old. So the same thing must not be visible in my action. Only if this happens can I say it's the same man. The same soul, the same life, the same vitality is at work. A child must not live like his grandmother, but it must become grandmother, which is something very different. And this now is expressed in the great achievement of the tribal order. In the tribal order, death is survived. Death is survived. Not that it is denied, but it is survived. There's a second difficulty in your vocabulary. Everybody today in anthropology speaks of the tribes in the plural. Now, that is not the consciousness of primitive man. Primitive man is the tribe in the singular. You cannot understand tribal mentality by reading all these books by anthropologists, because they are all pluralistic. They are all just poked there and poked there and say, this tribe has done this, and this tribe does this. It's true, you see. But the raison d'etre, the motivating power in the tribe's aura and law and folklore and dances is that there's only one tribe, my tribe. The other can either be slaughtered or can be forgotten, or they don't count. They once have been mine too, they split off. The singular, gentlemen, is lacking in anthropology today to a terrible extent. That's why I feel my anthropological friends, I have some, are all wrong. They are not wrong about their facts. They are not wrong about their research. They are devoted men who have sacrificed perhaps a lifetime to understand the dialect you see on Borneo or Java or New Guinea. But they have been corrupted by our high school teaching and our college teaching, in which we hear something about the migration of tribes. You must have heard this term. Who has not heard the term migration of tribes? Now, by this stilted word, migration of tribes, the plural has been sown into your consciousness. And the first time you heard of tribes was in this connection with the migration of tribes, I'm sure. Before, tribes do not play a real part. But migration of tribes is allegedly an event which undermines the Roman Empire between 300 of our era, you see, and the year 800. And in these 500 or 600 years, Islam conquers the East, and the Germanic tribes conquers the West. And so there they are in an infinite plurality, in infinite numbers, Franks and Saxons and Bavarians and Arabs and what have you. And so you think today too, when you speak of these benighted Negroes, you think they are tribal. I wish you would have a little more respect for tribals. The power to believe in one perpetual stream of life, that's the essence of tribalism. You don't have this. You go to Macy's and buy a new coat. And then you are new men. No tribal man believes this. And for this he invented the first scripture. If you read the book of the anthropologists, they tell you that writing did not exist among them. Nothing is more idiotic. All tribes write. But they write on their own bodies. That's called tattoo. Tattoo is the first script of mankind, and it makes a man into a man, because from his puberty, from his initiation, to the rest of his life, he's the same man. Whether he loses his teeth or loses his hair, or whether he's sick or loses an arm or a limb, he is the man. The writer shows it. I have here for circulation an example of tattooing from the Amazonas River in South America. Will you kindly look at it and pass it on? And send it back, will you? I have only 11 prisoners. Pass it on.
having 10 girls standing there and form together an inscription. They are all the two that you have to see them standing in their solemn dance to understand what is written. The text of this editorial is only can only be desired if you subscribe to all the 11 girls. Pass it on. You understand that there is therefore a serious reason why I must ask you not to speak of tribes. You will never understand 20 tribes. You will always understand one tribe. All the anthropology today is a borrowed anthropology from humanism. There were the Greeks and the Romans, the rest were barbarians or primitive people. And from this on, we talk about the tribes. Never has man lived in a tribe. He has lived in the tribe. Because when a man speaks, and when a man says, I am William Smith, he means it. And nobody can deny that he is William Smith, who speaks the same tongue. The tribe has a tongue which is divine. The word is not language, because although the word language is not a bad word, it's derived from lang, lingua, which means tongue. The people in this tribe all have one tongue planted into them. There are great ceremonies about this, you see. When men at puberty is implanted, when the tongue is implanted into him, and there goes terrible suffering. He is tattooed, you see. He's beaten. He is nearly murdered. But if he wakes up, he no longer has a childish tongue, but he has a tongue of the tribe. And when he speaks, not he speaks, but the whole tribe speaks. That is, through me and through you, here as I am teaching, do you think I speak? If I do any good, we speak. The authority which has asked me to teach believes that I will speak in the name of truth, in the name of historical tradition, in the name of the necessary, in the name of tomorrow. Well, how many names you can give? And probably most of the men who are appointed to me have no idea what they have done. But they have faith in this vicarious representation, that when I say something, it is not my poor digestion which speaks, but the truth, experience, charity, hope, my wish to take you in into the community of men. And man, in this sense, is written M-A-N as a singular. And all the natural scientists who don't believe in God all believe in M-A-N. That is, they all believe, the physicists will always tell you, men must or men does. Now, what is this strange singular? All the books I read are always filled with this M-A-N, singular of men. They never say of men in the plural, as I do, carefully. But then they deny that man has to be made into a singular. The tribe knows this. The tribe says, in by themselves, these people are many, like fleas, like ants, like mice, like rats, like chipmunks, or what have you. Usually rats. But they can be made into one growth, one beautiful stem. And to stem from such a tradition, that's the humanity of which we speak when we enter history. History is the process of creating units by putting into us one tongue. The tribe, what is it? 500 people, 2,000 people, somewhere on the Pacific coast, somewhere in the Caribbean, somewhere in Africa. For you, that's all contemptible. You live by statistics, and if it isn't 10 million, you don't care. Gentlemen, these 200 people, the Yaruros on the Amazonas River, of which you see there this picture, they are 150 people, and they are in history, and you are not. You're just onlookers. You may get into history, but so far you haven't made the rank. You are not initiated. You have passed examinations,
which is a very poor substitute for initiation. Because in the initiation, you cannot copy from somebody else, but in your exams, you do. It's very serious, gentlemen. Most of us are too. We have to look for our initiation outside the rigmarole of the schools and the rigmaroles of what the family demands you see. You go to war, that's an initiation. Or you can fight the enemy at home. There are many ways of initiation, but few of you know that you are not initiated automatically, just by getting older. To getting older is no way of being initiated. And in order to be fair, you live at a very great moment, gentlemen and ladies, at the moment in which the initiation of men has now to be transferred to women. Never before in the history of mankind did women have to be initiated. They were not. They were expected to wait till the men who was initiated could call them, could woo her. Now that's a long, long story, thousands of years. And today we are, that's why this course is offered to you, for me, because I feel that between the year 1967 and the year 2035, which you probably all will reach, a tremendous step has to be taken of a new form of initiation, or into a new form of initiation. You cannot grow up any longer by high schools, grammar schools, and playgrounds. I mean, you can, but it isn't enough. There has to be some more. And the great innovation is that in the third millennium of our era, the Christian era, the man who has to be initiated will not just be male, but he will be male and woman. And that's the novelty. And that, I hope, will make you patient when I now talk about the past. It is not for nothing. I don't believe that we go back into the past for renewing it. But I think we go back into the past for knowing what is lacking among us. What is lacking today is initiation. Lacking today is this great prowess and this great pride of a man in the Caribbean to say that he is a descendant of the Kiboto tribe. In America, they said, used to say that if a man in California asked somebody who was your grandfather, he would be shot. Nobody asked such a question in an immigration country, you see. That was private. Now, the initiation of which we have to, with which we have to pull, will not be a racial initiation. Will not be an initiation of making you proud for your father or grandfather in the flesh. But there has to be an initiation just the same, because you have to inherit the powers by which man survives death, by which every generation can find themselves as continuing something, you see, and as not starting from scratch. And this is today a very painful process, and there is a difference between our era, in which I told you the Church Universal and the universe of heaven and earth. And now the universe of mankind, of humankind has to be created. This third universe, the birth throes of which you and I are undergoing at this moment, you see, will be very different from the pre-Christian era, because it must include women. And therefore man has changed his character in the last 2,000 years. Anything that has to be done today will have to be done by both sexes. Whereas in antiquity, and antiquity in this way has lasted until today, in many ways, in which both sexes are redeemed, are asked to come in and become conscious of their past. The woman has always married a man and changed her name. She was, you see, Miss Essex, and then married Mr. Wessex. And this was a problem. And it has been silently born. And there now the professional women begin to say, they have no two names. You see, they have just the name of their profession. And the more important name of their family and of their children is not mentioned. How was Miss Perkins? You remember? Anybody remember Miss Perkins? Right. Well, you never knew that she was married and that she had a family name. That she was a very good person, but she was Miss Perkins. That's only a half-baked initiation. Wasn't the whole story. Many professional women do this the same today. Only I would try to show you only that we are in the birth throes of a great new millennium. Something new has had to happen. The initiation of women is unheard of. And in order to arm you and me for this tremendous turn of the century, we go backward and look into the pre-Greek and pre-Egyptian and pre-Assyrian times in which tribes were founded in such a manner that without land, without books, without stones, without houses, people remember and knew that they were exactly in line with the long succession. If you would have the prowess and the ability to say, what I'm doing now is exactly in the best tradition of my ancestors 3,000 years ago, it would be quite a pedigree, a peerage, wouldn't it? Now that's what any primitive tribesman can say. You can't and I can't. If you know who your grandparents were, this is already very much. And what does it help? Obviously, our physical grandparents are not our true grandparents. We have other ancestors. We have many ancestors. You have to choose your ancestors. That will be the problem of future initiation. I anticipate the end of this course. There is something to be done. It hasn't been done yet. It is obviously not enough to have a grandfather, a grandfather, if you know nothing of him, and if he cannot educate you. But you have to have ancestors. Yes, that is, you have to stay same as conviction that you continue something. If you can't say this, it isn't worth living. The moment ice cream and Pepsi Cola is just not important enough. I mean, if your good digestion is all you can boast of, shoot yourself. Well, this is more than a joke. Because speech is not lodged in the stomach. It is not lodged in the brain. The power to say, this is me, is lodged in your genitals. The heart and the genitals of men are what connects him with the race. The stomach and the brain is that which connects him with the moon, with his own space environment. You think differently. You think that speech is a quality of the brain, of the mind. It's simply not true, because you can only be able to think out of people that have spoken to you. Spirit has been spoken into you. Because your mother smiles at you, you begin to open up, begin to think. The greatest heresy of the Greek century of which we emerge, or the Greek century, the classical era, I mean the humanistic era, is that people are told that this man of yours, you see, consists of a mind and a body. If it would consist of a mind and a body, you could have very strange ideas about me. But I wouldn't tolerate that you spoke to me. I would slap you in the face. Because anything you would say of me would be beneath my dignity. I am more than what you know. How can you address me in the proper manner if your mind is master? It is. What's this little mind? That's a tool of society implanting in you certain repetitious words. Yes, sir, or no, sir, or whatever it is. Speech is a sexual affair in the greatest sense of the word. Sex without song is sin. That's why you're suffering so much. You don't know this. You deny it. You think that sex is something by itself. The person who don't sing to his sweetheart has no right to have sexual relation with her. Courtship is a serious thing. Courtship is a connection of the whole manliness, you see, with the moon. Everybody knows this, everybody practices it. You hope that it will be true. If somebody speaks to you, that he will take you up on your totality. this sentence is mean what we the profound, but it is true. Sex without song is sin. People sing in order to be able to reproduce the race. As nothing racial is outside the logos, outside speech. The great heresy of the last 100 years from which you have to emerge or you will destroy you and your children and the world, China included, is not based on physics. It is not based on your bodies. And it is based on your power to sing to each other, to court each other. The first law of the tribe is that he cannot be human if there's incest. There is no primitive tribe, be it in Pacific or be it in the Atlantic Ocean, which allow that brothers marry their sisters. Only modern poets like Thomas Mann, Richard Wagner had such ideas. Incest is impossible because incest would be sex without song. If you sleep with your sister, you don't have to court her. You don't have to speak a new term. It is also unknown between you and me, I'm afraid, that he who courts, he who makes love, who he begins to say to a girl, really, I like you, learns to speak a second time. We are all depraved and corrupted and poisoned by the wonderful romantic idea of a mother tongue. Ladies and gentlemen, if you are worth the candle, your candle, you have to sing when you call your sweetheart or your another country to which you go, or whatever it is, your profession, you have to learn a second tongue, the bridal tongue of courtship. We all speak several languages. The first layer is English. Poor English, I mean. Daily English. When you are 14 or 15 or 16 and the hair is beginning to grow, you have to learn the power to speak something which nobody has ever heard before. A boy who has never written a line of poetry is in great danger of not being a full-fledged man. Because what is poetry? The power to say something for the first time. And what is mother tongue? The power to say what has been said again. Now, you and I consist of this tremendous dialectic that partly we have to go on saying what has been said always. How do you do? Nice weather, you see, etc. And the same man around the corner has to say to his sweetheart something she has never heard before. I hope she never listened to a man who doesn't do that. He doesn't deserve to be listened to. Because the same man has to say something for the first time, and something for the X time, for the thousandth time. Language lives on repetition and on new birth. That's what we call Renaissance. Renaissance is not something that happened in 1400 or 1500, you see, but it's something every student has to do. The difference of a college student and a man growing up in his parish and in his farm is just this. To go to college would be absolutely silly, and perhaps it is in many cases. I don't know this. But I mean, I warn you, unless in those 4 years in this college here, you learn to say certain things to somebody so that she says she has never heard this before, is impotent, has not the power of a man. Don't marry him. This has to do with initiation, because today it is unknown. People think that the mother, all nationalists in Europe, you see, got intoxicated and drunk with the mother tongue. And you know who these gentlemen were who prepared Hitler and the Third Reich, and the same thing, of course, in France, the nationalists in every country, the fascists in Italy, everywhere the same. They were all people who had gone to a gymnasium and learned Latin and Greek. And they never became conscious of the fact that by learning the second language, they had become very potent and very powerful, and were listened to in their nation. And thanks to the second language they learned in school, you see, and you do, you see, you suddenly overcome the laziness, the apathy of the mother tongue. That speech, after all, is just repetition. And you come to know, some in more, in higher degrees, and some in lower degrees, but every one of you knows something that in a good moment you can intone a verse, a song. And the moment you do this, the whole world begins again. To sing means to start. To think means to end. Now both is necessary. But if you live by thought, by mind only, you are in the dengue of history. You are reflecting. You are the last. We all have to be last at first. So I too have to think, I'm afraid. But that's not the end, that's the beginning. As soon as I've thought something through, I dismiss it. It's now clear. And I try to find something very obscure, which by a poem I begin to eclair, to lighten up. Illumination comes, you see, from the poem. And then you analyze Shakespeare, and then you write a thesis on the word fool in Shakespeare. All this is natural. These things every human being has known since the beginning of the world, and we have acted upon them. It isn't nothing that, but it shakes you now, as see, I know, because we have separated your own literary, poetical, political life from the greatest need, from your sexual life. This cannot be done. Sex itself is a way of making you as an individual subservient to the eternity of the race. That is sex. Sex is the entrance of a power that is bigger than you and me into us, demanding subjection. Any verse you write comes with the demand on us, you see, that has to be said. If this wouldn't be said, you see, if Lincoln hadn't given the second inaugural, the United States would not exist today. They wouldn't exist. You understand? That's quite something. No battles, and no guns, and no money, you see, and no consulates, and no embassies can save the United States from disintegration unless the speaker of this country, you see, is heard in the next and the next generation. Why? That's why you have to learn the Gettysburg Address. That's not a luxury. By the Gettysburg Address, you recognize anyone who has lived after 1863. Before, that's primitive man. Because here was a split nation, you see, who had to coalesce it again. That was much more than the Declaration of Independence from England. All the monuments of memory, then, be they stone or be they speech, make the race or the people or the eternity of time masters of the view of the moment. All our appetites, all our five senses serve the moment. I'm hungry, I eat. That's all right. But if I mistake my hunger for the historical demand on me, I'll never be able to go starve. And you have to live on a starvation diet for 2 years in order to save your country. Where is your claim that you must be satisfied? No soldier can serve under those conditions. And it's not just a soldier, take as a nurse in the hospital. Every one of us has to forego certain claims of his natural body all the time. They are secondary. And when I see all of you with these oily coiffures now and beards, I be aware, don't give too much to this. You see, man is not there to cultivate his ego. He is there to subject his ego to the needs and necessities of history. You have to be introduced, threaded in, so to speak. You see, how do you call it? What you thread in into a needle. See? Yeah, like a thread. And that's our problem. And we do it by beginning to speak time and again with a new enthusiasm, with a new language. Now, you well know that the tribal language has mastered this. As soon as you understand that the singular, the tribe, is the only congruous way of coping with tribes, that it is not true that any tribe considers other tribes, you see, but that he wants to be the genuine tribe, understand two things. That the whole world is their stage. All tribes migrate. That's not an accident. That is not just a byproduct of their existence. It's the essence that the universe, and we speak here of the universal history of mankind, you see, the universe is in a strange manner pronged in two prongs, so to speak, space and time. The earth has to be migrated, has to be wandered through, has to be conquered by movement. The tribe has to be on the move. A tribe that can no longer move ceases to be a full-fledged tribe, a sovereign tribe. It is a part of the tribal existence that they can change their springs and their fruit trees and their woods. The old Germanic tribes, you see, knew all about agriculture. But in the Roman days, for example, the famous Hermann the Cherusker in the forest of the Teutoburg. But they didn't allow themselves to stay put. Next year they had to go elsewhere to show that they were masters of their destiny. You go, you go, you go, you go. The migration of tribes is a misnomer. It's a migrating tribe of which we are speaking. Do you understand the difference? This migration of tribes, it looks as though at one time the tribes began to migrate. That's totally erroneous. All tribes we know are full-fledged tribes as long as they are able to migrate. When the English come in and occupy New Guinea, all of a sudden these poor tribes are no longer allowed to move. So they decay, as they do. And all these nice anthropological studies now on Mahai Valley and whatever the books are sick books, because they describe a tribe who, by a superior power, the great powers of the West, you see, has been negated his raison d'etre, his first power, that the whole world is open to him. So you find in Cambodia Eskimos, and you find Mongolians at the Amazonas River, the Bororos, and you find people from Melanesia in the Firelands in Patagonia. And it's a grandiose spectacle. The whole world has been migrated. Can you say this in English? Poor English, huh? But I have to use the term to show you that it's a conquest. The tribe shows its cohesion by being indifferent to the place at which it exists, you see. It can win over cold and heat, summer and winter, and that is the tribe that puts the cohesion of its generations above the cohesion of its land. All the great problems of anthropology are rooted in this great mystery that it is more important for the tribe to endure through the ages than to occupy much territory. This idea of the frontier and this idea of land hunger and so on is unknown to the tribal era. That's an invention of the people who came to this country in 1850. The tribe migrates in order to prove his identity through all ages. The first governing law is eternity, in time. Subject, subordinate to this is the relation to space. Somewhere in the bush, somewhere at a river, somewhere at the seashore. But quite indifferent. There's no religious aspect of the land. The religious aspect goes with the ancestors. And of course, the most prominent feature of the ancestors is the tattoo. The tattoo is the written language of the tribe. To share the tattoo through the ages, therefore, is a tremendous achievement. Next time I want to tell you the story of the 150 Yaruros at the Amazonas River who are dying out now in the last 30 years. They will disappear, there will be no Yaruros. But you can feel something of the reverence, I think, of mankind for his brother. They are doomed. No, nothing can save them. But they represent in a total purity the great power of men to last against his own little specimen of a physical stomach and a physical brain, and to see my heart and my genitals prove that I am the eternal man.